welcome to another episode of Nerds Amalgamated. I'm the professor and my co-host is the DJ. How are you going, DJ?
Oh, I'm going good. Another recording. Woohoo! We're going to the moon.
Yeah. You could not be more cringy today, could you?
hey. Elon Musk on the Saturday Night Live was great.
Yeah, and you realize Doge dropped 30% after he was on there?
Yeah, which was funny. I'm like, damn, man. I think it was Dogecoin's a hustle. I'm like, damn, man. You really had to say that, didn't you?
Yeah, I don't think you can trust Elon too. You can't predict Elon.
Nah, you can't predict him. Interestingly, he said that he was the first person with Asperger's to host Saturday Night Live, apparently.
Interesting.
Although, I'll go give Elon credit. He loves to put on a show and loves to attract the crowds, basically.
He's also just a tiny little bit of a jerk.
Come on, when you have that much money, you have the right to be a jerk.
Well, you don't have the right to it. You can just get away with it.
Yeah.
But on to our first topic for tonight. What did I actually... You know what? We always record at night, and I always say topic for tonight, but we release at 9 a.m. in the morning, so technically...
Well, if it's London time, yes, then it's night time, but...
Yeah. Anyway, our first topic for this episode, the epic Apple court case.
Dun-dun-dun! What is it, like the unstoppable force versus the immovable object kind of thing?
Kind of. Two companies with boatloads of money having an argument about who gets to make more money.
I mean, that's one way of putting it.
Yeah.
Although, I don't think Does Apple do any money in the gaming sector, or they're just... It's just
There was the Apple TV games, I think.
Oh, that must have been cringy as hell.
I don't really remember much about it. I think it was like Stadia, but on Apple TV.
Okay. I found a list. Here are some games for Apple TV in 2021. So you got Rayman Adventures, Dungeon Hunter 5, Song Pop Party, Horizon Chase World Tour, just random games, basically.
Okay, well, so I recognize two of those. Rayman is famous.
Mm-hmm.
Horizon Chase is a arcade racer game, just a little indie thing.
Yeah, but they haven't developed any games of their own, have they, Apple?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. Nothing too serious, anyway.
Yeah. This court case has been accumulating for months now, if I recall.
Yeah, court cases tend to do that. But they finally started having an actual hearing on it. And because of the way they have to release the documents they're using as evidence, we're finding out a lot of juicy little details. Like, the Epic Game Store is predicted to be profitable in 2024.
No.
Yeah, so no. By the time this all shakes out, Epic will have been running a game store at a loss for 5 or 6 years.
Wow, that's a pretty big bomb.
Well, they're making enough money off their other products, mostly Fortnite.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Not even Fortnite on PC. Their most profitable Fortnite platform is actually PS4.
Figures, yeah.
So it's kind of surprising they're using the PS4 to fund their push into PC gaming. So Fortnite's highest revenues, 46.8% on PS4, 27.5% on Xbox One, and only 7% on iOS, which is the big argument that's going on here.
You gotta hand it to Epic, though. Like, they've been running this up, they've been running this thing for years, and hiding this fact is very bold.
I don't think they've been trying to hide it.
I mean,
it's just not something that was worth telling people.
I mean, can you imagine, like, going to a stock investors meeting at Epic and you just say, like, okay, we have a confession to make. We've been running at a loss for 5 or 6 years and your investments have not been doing any dividends for those years. You'd be really pissed off, wouldn't you?
No, because it's not the whole company running at a loss. It's specifically the game store division.
Ah, okay.
So the people who operate the game store are separate from the people who run Unreal Engine and the people who run Fortnite and anything else they might have. And they're funneling money from their other divisions to continue funding the game store and buy out games, do the free giveaways. But it's a big surprise that, you know, they're still 3 or 4 years out of being able to make a profit on it.
I mean, the COVID situation isn't helping the situation in any sense.
Actually, COVID helped game stores a lot.
True.
Everybody being stuck at home meant people bought tons of games, and sales went up massively in early 2020.
Okay, I'll grant you that. But how much money did Epic Game Store make during that time? It must have been.
I don't have a source for that, but no. I think it would be somewhere probably a smaller increase than what Steam saw, because Epic just has fewer users. Although, assuming Epic users buy the same number of games as Steam users, I don't actually know the demographics. It's possible that, you know, Fortnite targets younger gamers, so it's possible that Epic Store users are actually younger than Steam users and might have less disposable income or more. I'm not, you know, this is all hypothetical.
Oh, okay, I hear something interesting for you. So in 2020, through the Epic Games Store, Epic Games lost $273 million in expenses.
Yes, and the profit that they expect to make in 2024 is only $45
million. I mean, damn. Okay, so what are the other juicy details from the lawsuit that you've encountered?
Well, Epic, you know, they've been buying out exclusives. According to the documents, pushing to get Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft first-party games on the store. Which, the most ridiculous part of that is the Nintendo. I kind of doubt that, you know, I'm sure they'd love to get it, but I doubt Nintendo is actually going to partner with Epic.
I mean, if... games companies, if they see a profit, they in the long term they could, but with this revelation and Nintendo, well,
Nintendo doesn't care. Nintendo does what Nintendo wants to do.
Yeah,
like
I get that.
Microsoft once went to speak to them about buying Nintendo, and apparently they were basically laughed out of the room.
I mean, that would have been hilarious if it actually fell through, though.
I think you're using that term wrong. Fell through usually means it failed.
Ah, sorry. Imagine if it succeeded, though, like if Microsoft bought Nintendo. That would have been a very, very funny union of sorts.
Well, yeah.
You imagine Nintendo Xbox.
Well, that kind of brings me to my next point. Microsoft has never made money on the Xbox hardware.
No. Yeah.
All of the money that the Xbox division makes is from selling software.
What?
So consoles are usually sold at a loss. You create this hardware and then sell it cheaply to get it into people's hands. Then once they have it, they're basically locked into buying games from you. You can then sell the games at a certain price and take a commission on that. And then you get the money that you can use to put into developing your next platform and hopefully keep dominance. Like the Xbox One generation hurt Microsoft because they really screwed up and Sony whipped them in that generation.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not impossible to sell a console for a profit. It's just that for the first couple of years, especially, the console is sold below cost. And that's also why they want to keep it locked down. They don't want people running custom code on the console, because if you do that, apart from enabling piracy, they're effectively selling you a computer below cost.
Yeah.
And you don't have to come back to them. That's why traditionally console manufacturers have been really locked down. The Xbox Series consoles seem to be less locked down. You can run emulators on them by putting them into, I think, developer mode, which is nice. I like the sound of the consoles being more open for indie developers.
Ironically, this is I was watching a video about what you were saying in terms of adding in emulators and software and stuff. There was a New Zealand traveler that went to Pakistan, and he was showing all these like shops of, oh yeah, you can mod these places, you can do mods and repairs and stuff. And I'm like, damn, man, cheap as hell as well.
Yeah, that's a thing in the West as well, though. You can buy a mod chip for your PlayStation on the online quite easily. You might not have the skills or technology to connect it, but you can buy it. And it really depends on the console. So the PlayStation 1, you need an extra chip to put in there.
Hmm.
The original Xbox, screw you, Microsoft, and your stupid naming system. The original Xbox, you just need to bridge two points on the board that put it into debug mode or something along those lines. You put it into some sort of debug mode, then you can install your custom software.
More details. I'm juicy. Yeah. It's some more details now.
Some more details on why the consoles are sold at a loss. Eventually, some consoles become profitable. That's happened for Sony and Nintendo.
Yeah. We've seen it
usually happen. That's because they find a way to simplify the board. They cut features. You know, the early model PlayStations usually have backwards compatibility.
Yeah.
And then they drop that in the Slim a year or two down the line. So they drop features like that, or if there's an update to the manufacturing, they might make the CPU on a different node and be able to get it cheaper and at a better yield. And that's why it's so hard to buy a PC at the same price as a console, because consoles are cheating.
Yeah. Interestingly, with the PS5, how they're starting to now add in SSDs as well, which is really weird.
Well, SSDs are dirt cheap these days.
Oh, yeah,
and they're not
yeah.
exactly putting in big ones. Like, they're not as cheap as a spinning disc, but we are hitting the technical limits of spinning discs.
Mm-hmm. I did read a bit on about this lawsuit, by the way, Professor. And I found a very interesting one in terms of a couple of competitors decided to start their own online games shop model as well, like Walmart, for example.
Yeah, it's becoming like the streaming market. For years, we had the one or two options, particularly in streaming, it was Netflix. Then everyone else realized they wanted a bit of that pie.
I mean, can you imagine Walmart becoming an online games retailer?
Yeah, it's a bit surprising. Now, there's something else. I've also read an analysis on Reddit based on some statistics that Epic released, and it's shown that player base is not tied to Twitch viewership.
Are you sure about that? I mean, normally it's the, like with Fortnite and stuff, it's the player base and Twitch would be in the same count.
Well, in this case, so obviously there are some cases where a game gets picked up on Twitch, then blows up, and millions of people play it.
Yeah.
Among Us is the currently most famous version of that. It started off really small, some Twitch players played it, and then it just exploded. But in this case, there is no correlation between the player count and the viewer count.
Huh.
So for Fortnite, at least, you know, we really need more data to be able to make a definitive statement on it. But some big streamers left Fortnite in 2019, which is the year the data is from, and viewership dropped significantly.
Yeah, I remember, I think that was the year when Ninja decided to
leave
Twitch for, what was it? It was for another brand.
Mixer.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, he told Twitch that he was going to leave it for, and to go for Mixer, and everybody lost their mind.
Yeah, and it worked out to be great for him because he made like $20 million and then Mixer shut down. So he's pretty sure he's going back to Twitch.
Yeah, he has. He has.
So he just made $20 million to take a 6 month to a year job. So around that same time, a lot of people stopped streaming Fortnite and player viewer count dropped dramatically. Monthly users didn't drop quite as much, like significantly less. Let me just double check the statistics. Yeah, so the player base is relatively stable compared to the viewership. And I think that makes sense. A lot of people probably do pick up a game because they see it on a stream or a YouTube video, but just because your favorite streamer starts playing something else, you're not going to stop playing your favorite game. And people follow streamers for the personality, not the games.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd like to see more data on this, but at least for Fortnite, it's not doesn't seem to be correlated. What it would probably do is show you trending ideas. So you'd probably see a jump in viewer counts when an expansion comes out, because people will go back to that game. Same for the player base. But when the streamers stop playing it, people don't stop playing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Tongue-tied myself there. When the streamers stop playing it, regular gamers don't stop playing.
They won't stop playing. They'll be fed with like more and more updates and stuff, and then maybe Ninja, for example, but hey, there's a new update. Maybe I'll try that one out, and they'll still play it. They'll still continue on, and the regular player will still continue playing it until he's bored out of his mind. But
yeah.
But now I don't know. I mean, like, Fortnite's has been surviving for long. And I mean, what was the last big game that came out that was supposed to be a Fortnite killer? The Fall Guys, for example.
I think people threw around Fortnite killer for no good reason. People did the same thing with World of Warcraft when everyone was making MMOs.
Yeah.
Everybody made MMOs, and everybody's MMO was the World of Warcraft killer. And World of Warcraft's still going strong. So I don't think, you know, I think people are too quick to declare something the killer.
Yeah, it was funny, last year they were putting Valorant as the Fortnite killer. I'm like, no.
Yeah, I don't get that myself, because Valorant's not a Fortnite type game. It's not a battle royale. It's a
team shooter.
Yeah, team shooter. More like CS:GO.
Yeah.
So really, Valorant would be up against CS:GO, not Fortnite.
I think they were trying to make it like, oh, this it's attracted a lot of people. This is going to be the Fortnite killer. That's why. Like, they were even putting Apex Legends as the Fortnite killer as well, ironically.
That makes more sense, because Apex Legends is a battle royale.
Yeah.
And sometimes these games will, you know, pick up a big player base in the first month or two, and that'll drop off over time. But to kill an entire game like Fortnite, you really need to do everything Fortnite does better. Mm. And it's very hard to do that without being just a Fortnite knockoff.
Yeah. Although, mind you, Fall Guys was bought by Epic Games, I think, earlier this year.
Yeah.
So if you can't beat them, join them.
Yep. But again, Fall Guys is a different type of game entirely as well. It's not even a shooter game.
Nah, it's not even, okay, yeah, I grant you the fact that it's not really even a shooter game, but it's more like a competition style game, like, you know, Last Man Standing, that kind of.
Yeah, it is a battle royale, but it's a platformer battle royale.
Yeah. So with this court case, so they announced like how much they're suing for and stuff like that, or is it just?
I'm not aware of anything like that. I do know the court case is about the Epic Games Store. Well, Epic Games having a bit of a spat with Apple because they don't want to pay Apple tax.
Oh, man. Taxes.
Well, yeah. So Apple takes 30% cut for games sales made on iOS. And Epic decided they don't want to pay that anymore and tried to find a workaround. Apple blocked them from the App Store, and that's how this has all gone down. And now they're in court deciding whether they get to be allowed back onto the App Store, and to an extent whether Apple's 30% cut is worth it. But as I mentioned earlier, only 7% of Fortnite players are on iOS. So Epic could pretty much drop iOS completely and not see a huge loss.
Yeah, but even if Apple, even if Epic were to go down, right, and say, okay, you know what, screw you, Apple guys, we're not going to put it on iOS, you're going to face a lot of backlash. Like,
yeah, the gamers won't be happy, but the Epic shareholders probably won't be hugely happy, but it's not going to be the end of the world.
But it might turn into like a cut your nose despite other people, that kind of scenario, though.
Despite your face.
Yeah.
Yeah, the point of that is just hurting yourself to for no good reason, basically. So, yeah, it could be that, you know, they if they lost that 7%, it's not the end of the world, but they don't want to lose that 7%.
Nah.
So they're going to try to avoid cutting it off entirely, because as it is, they're only losing 30% of that 7% sales. If they were, if they get kicked off iOS entirely and don't get back in, that's a full 7% of their sales gone.
The problem's going to be, as I said, the problem's going to be the goodwill of the fans. It would taken away in its entirety. That'd be the downside to it. But financial-wise, it's
I think most people who play on mobile probably also own a laptop. And Fortnite isn't the most demanding game.
Nah, nah.
So you could probably play Fortnite on a reasonably cheap laptop. So I don't think it's, you know, the end of the world. I think most people will probably change platforms if they had to.
The question will be, what type of laptop are they going to get? Imagine there you get the iPhone users going, okay, I'm going to start playing Fortnite on my Apple Mac laptop.
I think you can do that.
Yeah, but come on. Like, would you really want to play a game on an Apple Mac, though?
Enough people do. I mean, I think they're making a big mistake, but some people do. But we should move it along to the next topic.
Yeah, yeah.
AI is a bit of a buzzword. Actually, it absolutely is a buzzword. People are throwing it in everywhere.
Hey, gotta thank Hollywood for making it a buzzword these days.
Well, it's not just that, but every business, every startup will say they're using AI and machine learning. Even if what they're doing isn't strictly AI, they'll claim it because people who don't know better think that it's
the future.
Big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the future. The future is now.
It is. AI is the future, but there are better ways to do some things. That you'll find a startup doing something with AI, and there will be a better way to do it without AI. And they're just using AI so they can use the buzzword, we have an AI-powered platform.
I can imagine now Apple just going, introducing the new iPhone. I don't know what number they are on right now, but introducing this new iPhone is with its screen AI powered.
Okay, Google does actually do that.
Really?
Not for the screen though. Google has a chip. I don't remember the name of it, but it's a post processor for the camera, and it's in the flagship Pixels, not in the A model Pixels. But at least that was the case for the Model 3 Pixel. I don't remember the Pixel details on the Pixel 4. And it's an AI-powered post-processor that allows it to take really good photos in poor conditions. In my experience, the 3A and 4A still take really good photos. So I don't know how much of a loss it is. I do know that for the 3A, apparently it took slightly longer to take the photo because it's doing the processing on the CPU rather than the dedicated AI chip.
So
we're digressing a bit.
Yeah. Before we move on, though, the chip is going to be called Whitechapel.
Okay.
That's the name of the chip. So, yeah.
In the Pixel 3 models, it was a Pixel Visual Core chip.
Okay.
And in Pixel 4, it's been replaced with Pixel Neural Core. But so our actual AI topic is that in the past 3 years, AI has diagnosed 20 Australian prostate cancer victims who would not have been picked up by classical testing. So even though they are having this in the case study in the article, Greg Smith, he was having regular testing because there's a genetic link to prostate cancer. It wasn't until he decided to submit his test through Maxwell Plus that he actually found out he had cancer, not knowing from his regular checkups that he had cancer, because the regular checkups just couldn't find it.
Huh.
And that's the advantage of AI here. I don't fully understand how the AI picked it up or what the testing involves, But AI medicine is, I think, one of the exciting avenues. In this case, it picked up this cancer that had no other symptoms. In other cases, they're training AI to detect cancerous cells in samples. And the advantage of that is that the AI can look at more samples for longer and pick up on things that humans can't.
Yeah, they're saying here that the technology is combined with a simple blood test to find out what the patient's risk of disease is.
Yeah, and you can also use AI to crunch your data and pick out associations that human scientists have missed. So if you use the AI to analyze data, you feed in all of your data and you know, you're expecting it to come out with A equals B, but it will also come out with C equals B, and nobody's ever looked at C before. It might not be an obvious thing there. AI doesn't see things the same way humans do. And once an AI model picks up on something, it's not like you can go in and edit the code and take it out again.
No.
Just because of the way the AI works. So you end up with an AI taking a different path to the solution that might actually be more efficient.
The interesting part about this is some people are assuming that this could take away the role of the GP.
I don't think it would ever completely take away the role of the GP. I think what you're more likely to see is that AI will supplement a GP. I don't think AI is at the point yet where you'd allow it to make all the decisions. You'd still want to have a human in the loop just to pick up on any mistakes. Humans make mistakes, but and that's why you have a second human in the loop. Often, if you get prescribed medicine, when you go to the pharmacy, the pharmacist will double check your script and they might pick up on something the doctor missed. They might see that, you know, drug A interacts with drug B and that's bad. But if they give you drug B and drug C, that also that works just as well, but without the side effects. So I think it's one of those things where you still want a human in the loop just for the odd case that it doesn't work out. But the AI will pick up on the patterns that indicate disease and provide that information to the GP for the GP to then help you with your treatment.
But then the problem with when it comes to AI would be what if there is like not much data on a certain disease. Let's say, for example, I have this very rare blood disease and I have all these symptoms. But the AI goes like, oh, we don't really have much data. What do we do?
What does your GP do when that happens?
He would say we'll take a blood test.
But what if you've got a condition that the GP doesn't know about? Or even your specialist, you might go to a specialist and they might not know what your condition is. It, particularly for uncommon diseases, humans aren't any better at AI than AI at that. And the AI has the advantage of not forgetting. So your doctor might be having an off day and miss something. The AI doesn't really have off days like that.
Imagine sooner or later they'll start saying like, your home AI goes like, "Hey, professor, while I was going through your urine sample and your poop samples, I found that there is a little bit of a little bit of a high salt content. You might be going through a bit of a cancerous phase."
Actually, yes, there are companies that have done that.
Are you serious?
Yeah, no. There are companies that are working on AI-powered toilets that will automatically analyze your waste and pick up on anything that's going wrong before it goes severely wrong.
Oh, no. But that's going to be the crazy thing, though. Like, can you imagine you stretch the AI in finding diseases to your home? Like, that would be like your AI determines what your diet will be because of your condition.
Yeah, that's important even in hospitals these days.
Oh, yeah, that is important. But, like, come on, there has to be moments where you just go like, but I miss eating chocolate, okay? I know I have this condition.
And, you know, you can still eat chocolate. You just might be recommended to cut back on it. unless you're having an allergic reaction, I don't think, I'm not an expert. I'd have to consult with my my girlfriend, because she's actually done a placement as a dietitian in a hospital. So she'd have a better idea than I do. But I don't think that's, I don't think they completely cut you off from things, particularly if you're not hospitalized.
Yeah.
But a dietitian can help pick up on different diets that might help with different conditions, not just like, you know, you're diabetic, so monitor your sugar, or you have celiac disease, so avoid gluten. But there's research going on into the role of your diet in other areas. So whether your diet influences your cancer growth, or whether it can affect other conditions. So an AI might be able to analyze your waste, pick up on what nutrients are missing or not being absorbed correctly, and then modify your diet to help improve that. But I think one of the big advantages of medical AI is that they can be monitoring you 24/7, which sounds a bit creepy and stalkery, but the AI, like with these AI toilets we were just talking about, if it scans your waist, you know, once a day, it picks up on any changes before it gets worse. So it might pick up that there's a different level of a certain hormone in your waist and identify that as a sign of cancer of that particular gland. And then you'd get it picked up when the cancer is still tiny, rather than waiting for it to completely take over the gland and need a full
surgery just to get rid of the cancer.
So I think that's the advantage of AI in medical treatment, that it can give you more frequent checkups. There's just not enough manpower to collect this much data, but putting the AI into the toilets and the scales and every other sort of tool that you just happen to interact with that could then collect data on your health from that tool. It the sort of thing that you need an army of doctors monitoring you 24/7 to pick up, because you're not going to go and pee in a bottle every day so your doctor can do an analysis every day. But you pee in your toilet every day, I hope, and your toilet can do the analysis. So greatly reducing manpower cost. Not completely replacing doctors, you still need the human in the loop, but greatly reducing manpower costs while greatly increasing the amount of testing that can be done, and also finding correlations that human eyes have missed. I think that's the big advantages with this sort of technology.
Yeah, that's true. Sooner or later, we'll have our homes be like an Iron Man with a hey Jarvis, can you do my blood toxicity level? I think I drank too much alcohol. Will I be able to drive?
Prescribing mineral water and whatever else you have for a hangover, I don't know.
Eggs and a Bloody Mary.
Prescribing Bloody Mary. And then you'd stumble into your kitchen and it would pop out on a little shelf. And
but in terms of disease detection and stuff, I mean, it's a start. It's a good start. But yeah, it'd be good to see more of this sort of technology. And imagine putting this in various other settings instead of at the GP and stuff. So yeah,
With the toilets, maybe the toilet could have a sensor in it that would pick up on prostate cancer in the urine.
Yep.
Something along those lines.
Yep. Something along those lines, but yeah. Or maybe like it could just go like, have a sensor, but then it would just email it to your doctor going like, hey, this guy's salt content just went up. Should I be worried?
Yeah. And then you get a phone call from your doctor asking you to come and make an appointment.
Yeah.
I think it would also help people who might not notice something going wrong themselves. Like, I'll be honest, I had a condition last year. I didn't notice that, you know, my health was slowly deteriorating over the course of a year until I went to the doctor and they're like, so your level should be this much, but it's this much. So having an AI in the home that could pick up on that would be great, because you don't always notice that, you know, things are going wrong and you should get checked out, because it just happens so slowly.
Yeah. And what's the other interesting part about this is that it's focusing on a certain disease that affects men as well.
yeah, there's not a lot of funding in prostate cancer. And so part of the reason is that a lot of prostate cancers happen in older men, and it's considered less of an issue because if you're old and you get prostate cancer, you're probably going to die with it, not from it. But if you're younger and you get it, you're more likely to die from the prostate cancer because you have more time for it to metastasize.
Yeah.
And, you know, men in particular don't always go to their doctor when they should.
Of course, we're a bunch of hypochondriacs.
Hypochondriac.
Yeah.
And this is a much more tasteful way of detecting cancer and spreading awareness than the Brazilian testicular cancer mascot, Mr. Testiculo.
Wait, what?
I am not kidding, Mr. Testiculo.
Oh, God.
It's a mascot, a giant pair of balls.
No!
Raising awareness of testicular cancer.
No! No! Oh my God, my goodness.
No, it's great. Like, it's just so ridiculous.
Oh God. What is it? Oh man.
No pictures in the Wikipedia article.
Thank God. I think I've seen it on Google Images, and I'm mortified beyond belief.
Yeah.
Oh my God, there's even a guy wearing it. It looks so weird. I hate to be the guy wearing that costume.
Can we have like Disneyland, but instead of people wearing Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse, it's all health mascots?
And you want what? Mr. Testiculo to be at the front gate?
Of course. So it's funny, when I Google Senhor Testiculo, yeah, one of the first images that comes up is looks like Jonah Hill.
Yeah.
I'm like, the resemblance is uncanny.
Oh, God. Oh, God. There are some things man should never see.
So that's how Brazilians handle men's health. But, you know, this is all, strapping that up, this is all great news for the 20 people it's discovered with cancer, especially since a lot of them wouldn't have picked up on it until it had gotten worse.
Yeah.
And with cancer, often an early treatment is a significant impact on mortality.
Yeah, I think that I think there should be more research on this on this avenue, and I think it will benefit a lot more people besides men. It could also benefit
men, but the women and children too.
Yeah. Especially the older men and older women. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'd like to see this technology expanded. I want to see more AI models for detecting disease. I want to see more day-to-day life sensors. I found out recently the newer Google phones have like heartbeat sensors, and they also use the camera to do breath rate analysis.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, so little sensors like that, you could take 5 minutes a day just to do some basic tests that would feed into an AI and pick up on any issues before they become severe. Of course, there's the data privacy aspect of that. One thing people are concerned about with data privacy, if you get a genome test, is it legal for your insurance company to then go and reject your insurance because you have a pre-existing condition because of your genetics, things like that? There's a lot of debate about that.
Yeah. So there'll be a lot of ethical issues when it comes to this. But I don't know. I mean, like, would you want to ignore the ethical issues? Because I mean, there's a lot of benefits to this, but then the ethics part, like, do I really, like, I could say stuff the ethics and just do it for the benefit of mankind.
Yeah, I think even just for yourself, it's a great help. But I am a little concerned about all these startups collecting medical information.
Yeah. Or government organizations as well.
Yeah. Last year or the year before, there was a major hack of, I don't remember who was hacked now, but it released a lot of data on people's mental health, a lot of diagnosis and identities. And right, you could go in there and find out Bob from down the road has schizophrenia or something like that. And wasn't, you know, that information being out in the public isn't the best.
Was this in Australia or?
In the US.
Okay.
Googling mental health data hack, I'm finding lots of articles here. It looks like the most,
Was it FireEye?
No, FireEye's a different. They could have gotten in through FireEye, but I think that's a different scenario.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there was one in October last year in Finland, one in the US in December last year, and the latest is, I know it's an article from this week about the Finnish hack, which I'll just throw in the show notes so we have a reference for that. So, you know, they're collecting this information and then not securing it properly. That's my big concern.
Yeah.
It's hard to, like, it's hard to secure something and have it be absolutely, completely bulletproof. On the other hand, having access to this information and being able to aggregate it and feed it into the AI can give you a ton of data that you couldn't pick up before. It's, complicated ethical issue.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, even if you put in a lot of firewalls, I think the hackers will still find a way. So it's a losing battle.
It's an arms race.
Yeah.
Your security team need to be absolutely on top of their game, but there are so many little things that can let a hacker in.
Yeah.
And even if your servers are the best, most secure servers, it doesn't always protect you against an inside threat.
No, it won't.
Someone might walk in and find a computer unlocked, or an employee who thinks they're going to get fired might steal all the data. It's a complicated issue, and we are digressing quite a bit, which we seem to be doing today.
Yep.
Normally, my episodes aren't too bad for digressions. So anyway, what's your topic tonight, DJ?
So
we're recording in the afternoon. What is up with my head? This is
the sun has gone down, Professor. The sun has gone down, has it?
Apparently. Normally we record at night, but
so my story is about how a Montreal-based comic book company is suing Marvel and DC for ripping off a design multiple times in its Iron Man, Ant-Man, and Avengers movie.
So the common denominator there is that Iron Man.
Yep, Iron Man and the Avengers, yeah.
So they're claiming Iron Man's costume?
Yeah, well, the costume design, but yeah, basically. And basically the story is Horizons Comics and its founders Ben and Raymond Lai allege that Marvel used their designs without consent or compensation and are suing for damages and injunction to and I quote, put an end to this deliberate and persistent infringement and to order defendants to pay compensatory or punitive damages to the plaintiff, in addition to Horizon's costs, which include solicitor-client costs.
Okay, but why do Horizon think that they own the Iron Man costume?
So it started with the three volumes of the Radix series, which were published by Image Comics, and has been sold to the comic book industry for tens and thousands of copies in Canada and USA. And the suit says that Marvel's now editor-in-chief, Chester Sobolski, approached the Lai brothers to work for Marvel based on the popular series, but they declined the offer. So this is the similarities they were saying. So Marvel's third Iron Man movie was released in 2013. The pop brothers noticed the similarities between the third, between the armored costume worn by Robert Downey Jr. and their designs. The costume changed in each of the Iron Man films. The Iron Man suit in the third installment, as the lawsuit reads, strikingly similar to the suit worn by by a Caliban, one of the characters portrayed in Horizon Works Radix number 1. And Horizon Comics filed this lawsuit in 2013, which was partially dismissed, although it was allowed to proceed based on similarities to the movie's poster design and Caliban suit. Justice Paul Oakton, however, reached a non-infringement conclusion in Horizon, citing hefty legal bills of more than $1.5 million. Saying it does not have the funds to complete its legal fight.
Okay.
Yeah, and interestingly, Marvel was... Oh, sorry.
Well, I do see that they also had a go at MIT for using their design in an image for a nanotechnology research grant.
Yeah. Which is interesting. I'm like, wow, really? MIT? Copying? So
it looks like they published Radix. MIT borrowed the design and got in trouble and then apologized publicly. Then a month after the MIT apology, Marvel hired the Lay brothers to work on Marvel Comics.
Yeah. And there's another lawsuit. So this new lawsuit argues that the further Marvel releases that featured Iron Man, including the 2018 Avengers Infinity War, consistently appropriate Horizon's work. The new Iron Man suit in the Avengers film, as the lawsuit argues, is now substantially similar to the Radix character Maxwell. And the suit's reading, in sum, not only one of the distinctive features raised by Justice Oakton in the American proceeding no longer present in Infinity War suit, but several additional strikingly similar features on the Radix suit were added.
Okay, actually, I've been pulling up pictures of these characters, and yeah, I do see the resemblance. The Iron Man costume is pretty similar to these other costumes. On the other hand, it's a suit of power armor. How different could it be? But there are a lot of details there, like little things that really look
identical.
Yeah, things that really look sus.
You reckon it's a bit of a bit, they're stretching a bit though, or you reckon they have an actual case?
I think I can see a lot of details on the suits that seem to match up. I think it'll come down to whether it can be considered copyrighted. Where did the original idea for these characters come from? Maybe the Radix costumes were inspired by real-world designs. Like, the MIT team used the Radix costume. Maybe it's inspired by previous projects. So, you know, who actually has the prior art on this? I do think, like, superficially they look different, but I think the more I look at it, the more elements are jumping out at me. Particularly,
I'll put up a picture. So this is from the Infinity War post, one of their posters.
Yeah, that Infinity War image there. It looks like actually that's a shot from the front of a magazine that they're using. But that's the particular image I was looking at. Like, particularly the areas have highlighted, but I also see a similarity on his abdomen. They both have that sort of face pattern on their abs.
Oh, yeah.
Although the Radix guy doesn't have the wings or a few other features that Iron Man has, but Iron Man does have a lot of features that the Radix guy has. I've seen another, even the gauntlets look a bit similar. And it does make me wonder if the Lay brothers, or Lay brothers, however you pronounce that, worked with Marvel in the early 2000s, though. But if they worked with Marvel at some point, did they show around their comic? And did somebody at Marvel, who still happens to work there, it has been, you know, almost 20 years. Not that long when when Iron Man 3 came out, though. I do see one of the comparison shots is, I think that's the Iron Man 3 poster. Iron Man and their character are both doing the standard hero 3-point landing pose.
Yeah, but apparently, so in that case, mind you, so this is strikingly similar to the lawsuit claims In the other ones, it's strikingly similar to the suit worn by Caliban, one of the characters portrayed in Horizon Works Radix number 1. It is worth noting that Horizon Comics filed suit against Marvel in 2013, which was, this was the one that was partially dismissed, but was allowed to proceed concerning the movie poster design.
Okay. So, yeah. What's even more striking for me, though, is Ant-Man.
Oh, yeah.
So the traditional Ant-Man design looks kind of like a guy in a weird spacesuit, but then they have the Radix costume, suit of armor type thing, which looks very similar to the modern Ant-Man design.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, now when I look at it, I don't know. I mean, okay, while this case does seem like it might have grounds, but then, to be honest with you, it feels like a couple of nitpicks in a sense.
It does. Like, are they... I'm not 100% sure here whether, you know... I thought maybe initially that since they'd also had the spat with MIT, maybe they were just copyright trolls, taking them to court for their for vague similarities, hoping that they settle.
If this court case goes through, it'd be very interesting to see what we might see pop up. Like, I mean, who knows? Maybe DC would go like, "Hey, Tony Stark, Tony Stark, you're copying Batman because you're also a rich guy as well."
I think that's suitably different, though.
Yeah, I know, but it's...
Batman's more about his physical ability. Like, has the tech, but Iron Man is all tech.
Oh, yeah, he's got all tech and stuff, but then both of them are stunningly rich billionaires, in essence. Yeah. So, like there'll be, like, other little nitpicks that people will try and use to, like, go, "Hey, you're copying our work," that kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think Marvel and DC would have had it out already if there was a case there. They're big companies. They can afford tons of lawyers.
Yeah. And interestingly, Disney's response to this entire fiasco, they shrugged it off.
Yeah, Disney's going to pretend that they don't care. But Disney will care if it starts hitting their bottom line.
Yeah.
If Radix win the Horizon win the case and they have to pay royalties, Disney would definitely care then.
Oh, yeah. Especially with their thin margins.
Mm-hmm. But we'll move along from there onto our nerdful things. What have you done this week, DJ? What did you do?
I went and saw the Snyder Cut again.
Why?
Nah, I'm just kidding. I didn't even do that. I just love trolling you with that now.
You're an animal.
What did I do? Damn, I haven't been doing much, to be honest. Like, I've been watching Final Space, and it's been a roller coaster of emotions with that series as of late.
Yeah, don't spoil it for me though, because I'm waiting for it to come out on Netflix.
Yeah, I will say this though, it's this recent episode, it's very eye opening and does open up a theme about a concept called closure. That's all I'm going to say about that one. But
okay,
yeah. There are some tender moments with this new episode, so I won't spoil much.
The show's always been great at tender moments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Even last week's episode, I will not spoil. There were some really nice moments in that episode. I just want to go like, I cannot believe they did that. How could they? But yeah, with this one, I would give this one a 3.5 out of 5. Like, there were some moments in this episode where you just want to go like, "Oh, what the hell are you doing, man? Why are you?"
Is it as good as the first two seasons?
Ooh, they're better than the first two seasons.
Oh,
but,
wow.
Yeah.
Wait, but so you're rating it 3 out of 5, but it's better than the first two seasons?
The reason why...
What did you rate the first two seasons? The explosion happening in Europe. But then at the end of season one, he decides that, you know, they have to go back to the bar where he met Quinn. And the bar's in New York.
Wow, that is one interesting detail. like the explosions in Europe, but they travel to New York.
Yeah. So, you know, how did they travel really quickly from New York to Europe to go to the spaceport? Because I don't think they actually, like, traveled there. I think they just ran down the street to the...
Teleporter?
No, there's no teleporters in the show. Well, there are, but I think the spaceport must have been close to the bar. I don't think it's likely that they actually, you know, traveled all the way to Europe and then hopped in a spaceship for an urgent mission.
The one thing I will never understand with the entire show is, are they trying to make Gary like the current, this generation's version of... Star Trek's Pike with who's that director that did the recent Star Trek movies? God,
Joss Whedon.
Joss Whedon? I thought it was some
Or was it J.J. Abrams?
Yeah, that's the one.
I always confuse those two.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, J.J. Abrams' version of Kirk in Star Trek. I feel like Gary is this generation's version of Kirk.
Okay.
Although, mind you, like, Kirk was much more daring and much more braver than Gary. Gary's just like, I'm not brave, I'm just an idiot.
Yeah, Gary's an idiot, but he somehow pulls it off.
Yeah. So what notable thing have you done, Professor?
I watched the Netflix movie Stowaway.
Oh, yeah?
It's a drama movie based on, possibly based on a short story called The Cold Equations. Basically, there's a crew of three people on a mission to Mars, and they find a stowaway on board, but they don't have enough resources to keep everyone alive.
Okay.
And I think I have to give it only 2.5 out of 5.
Really? Wow.
That's I'm really disappointed because it uses Scott Manley as a science consultant.
Okay, who's Scott Manley?
He's a YouTuber. Like, he's actually trained as an astrophysicist, but he does a lot of space games on YouTube, Kerbal Space Program, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
But because of that, he spends a lot of time, you know, going in depth on the science of his rockets and designs and the games. So I'm disappointed that a few things are just a bit weird. So my main issue, they don't explore how the stowaway got on board. They actually say, you know, when he arrives on board, they find him behind a panel, and they ask him how he got there, and he says, "Well, I was working on the spaceship, you know, bolting it all together and doing some checks before the launch, and then I remember falling, and somehow he's inside." But they never explore, like, is he lying? Did somebody put him there? Maybe I'm being a bit harsh to Scott Manley. I suppose the science is decent. It's just that there are some plot points that don't make a lot of sense. But, you know, how did he get on board the ship, bolted in behind a panel, when his job was on the outside of the ship? Why are they only carrying enough, like, one single CO2 scrubber? And why is it, like, it's not a complicated device in the movie. It's really small, but it gets damaged, and that's why they run out of oxygen. It's not like there wasn't room for a second one. So
2.5 out of 5, eh?
Yeah, I enjoy the story. I enjoy the moral dilemma. I just think how they got there and a few other things. You know, there's some really good scenes of spacewalks and stuff. It's got nice CGI. Visually, it's pretty stunning, but the story just really drags it down for me. There's a lot of holes in it. And yeah, they never seem to really explore that. But I do like that they explore, you know, they've got this extra guy on board, there's not enough oxygen, how can they get more, or how can it be ethical to kill this guy so that everyone else can live? And, you know, who dies, who lives? I think it's, I don't want to give it a 3 out of 5, but maybe I will, because it's a good, good drama, just I don't like how they got where they were, sort of.
Okay.
Apart from the holes, the moral dilemma is really good.
Okay.
I also looked up the Cold Equations after I watched it and found out that, and someone compared it to that, and I think that's pretty good too. So we'll have a short break and then be back with our events of interest.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So, starting with our shout-outs, on the 3rd of May, we had the 25th anniversary of The Craft. You're a bit of a fan of this one, aren't you, DJ?
Oh, yes, I am. Hey, it was the 90s, and witchcraft was a thing.
Big in the 90s.
Yeah, hot chicks and witchcraft.
That's a bit weird, though. I see in the summary you've given me that other movies and TV shows have done witchcraft, Broad City, Charmed, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and Pen 15.
I know.
I mean, that doesn't sound right.
No.
Just a quick Google search says that it's a cringe comedy show. I don't immediately see witchcraft, but I guess it must be an episode with that or something.
Well, the plot saying here, like, it's described as middle school as it really happened, where they're both the two girls are both 31-year-olds at the start of season one, play versions of themselves as 13-year-old social outcasts in the year 2000. Oh,
wow.
Surrounded by actual 13-year-olds.
That sounds bad.
No, it's the cringe comedy part.
And it says that the best day of your life can turn into your worst with the stroke of a gel pen. Is that hinting at a magic pen? Or is it something more mundane? Who knows? So you're into 90s witch shows?
Back in the good old days, you know, the 90s. I was a teenager and hot chicks and witchcraft. I mean, who wouldn't say no to that?
Okay. I know a lot of these 90s witch shows have reboots. Do you think any of them are any good? Have you watched them?
I saw the trailer for the reboot of Charmed, and it was it doesn't have the chemistry in the old seasons. Like, the old series were fun to watch. They had, like, bits of comedy, and there was a bit of drama and family and stuff. But, yeah, these ones, it was just, what are you doing, man?
That kind of thing. I think it's hard to make a show that, to reboot a show and capture the attention of the people who like the original and the next generation.
Yeah.
It's hard to make sort of intergenerational TV like that, I think.
Yeah.
Especially since the people who lived through the original show have built up, you know, it might not have been as great as they think it is, but they've built up good memories of it. So they might go back and watch it and think this is terrible, but in their heads, it's still the best thing ever. On the 4th of May, Bill and Melinda Gates announced their divorce. Although they are getting divorced, they plan to continue working together in the foundation, and it seems like they are having a fairly amicable divorce. They originally met at a work dinner. Melinda beat Bill at a maths game, and they got married in Hawaii in 1994. Also, a bit of a coincidence, they're the second high-profile Seattle billionaires to end their marriage in recent years, the other being Bezos.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Although, hell of a investment. You spend 25 years married and you divorce and you get, like, $100 million, however much it worked out to be, I don't remember. good to hear that they're having an amicable divorce and not a problematic one. There we go. Billions of dollars for the Bezos divorce. Not millions. I had a brain fart there. I do enjoy the memes, though. Like, I feel bad for them, but I enjoy the memes. I saw a blue screen the other day that said, "Oops, our marriage has encountered a problem and we have to divorce."
Oh, I saw one the other day where I saw one where Bezos is Bill Gates' missus is now one of the richest women because of this.
Yeah, I mean, while they're together, she's still technically one of the richest women on Earth. But now that they're divorced, apparently that makes a difference. Because legally, when you're married, your assets are mixed. So it just seems odd to me that, you know, they're only suddenly the richest women once they get divorced.
Mm-hmm.
Although we do consider they, in these cases at least, we seem to consider their husbands as the financial powerhouses of the family. So maybe that's why. Anyway, our next one we have... Oh, I was disappointed there. I thought the next one might have been on the 5th of May and we would have had a trifecta. But nope, on the 6th of May, we have the 30th anniversary of... The Shadow of Isobius.
Now you know how I felt. Now you know how I felt.
Yep. It's a Sierra Online game developed by Joe Ibarra and the first of three graphical MUDs. According to reviews from the time, it set the standard by which all future MUDs would be judged. So a MUD is a multi-user dungeon, and traditionally they were text-based. But then in the early 90s, we started having games like Shadow of Isobius, Ultima, and they were really the first graphical MMOs. Unfortunately, Shadow of Isobius was shut down in 1996 when AOL bought the company and considered it a competitor to their own Neverwinter Nights. There are fan projects to revive it, though, so... If you want to try out some 90s MMO, and be warned, they haven't necessarily aged well, you can give it a go. On our remembrance, we have on the 5th of May, 2007, Theodore Maiman. Theodore was an American engineer and physicist who is credited with the invention of the laser. His first laser was successfully fired on May 16th, 1960. He invented the laser while working at the Hughes Aircraft Company. His design was based on a synthetic ruby crystal, which other scientists felt wouldn't work. And the reason lasers are important is because they have what's called coherent light, which is perfectly in phase, perfectly the same wavelength. So when you turn on your light, you get a lot of different colors of light coming out of your light bulb. But a laser only gives you one exact wavelength of color. Maiman died from systemic mastocytosis at 79 in Vancouver. And for our famous birthday, on the 5th of May, 1830, we have John B. Stetson, an American hatter who invented the classic cowboy hat. And if you ever put that on, you immediately have to speak in a cowboy accent. It is non-negotiable. He also invented the Carlsbad hat, but his Stetson hat was named Stetson because he had the name John B. Stetson Company embossed in gold on the hat band. Stetson's Western hat style hats were worn by the employees of the National Park Service, the U.S. Cavalry, U.S. Presidents, and law enforcement. He was born in Orange, New Jersey. And for our event of interest, on the 5th of May, 1809, Mary Keyes became the first woman awarded a U.S. patent for a technique for weaving straw with silken thread. During the Napoleonic Wars, the U.S. embargoed trade with France and Great Britain, which led to Mary Keyes filling the gap in the straw weaving industry and developing her style of woven straw hat. Keyes wasn't the only American woman to innovate in hat making. In 1798, Betsy Metcalf invented a method for braiding the straw. Fortunately, the original patent file was destroyed in an 1836 fire. And on the 5th of May, 1961, two Atlantis movies were released in different countries. Atlantis, the Lost Continent, was released in West Germany. A Greek fisherman brings an Atlantean princess back to her homeland. He is enslaved for his trouble. The king is being manipulated by an evil sorcerer who is bent on using the resources of Atlantis to take over the world. The slaves of Atlantis are forced to mine a crystalline material which absorbs the sun's rays. The crystals can then be used for warmth. Science has created weapons from the crystals which fire a heat ray to destroy whatever it touches. The film included stock footage from other films, including Oscar-winning films Quo Vadis and the Naked Jungle. They also reused props from other productions, including a temple idol from The Prodigal, trail instrument gauges from The Forbidden Planet, and wardrobes from Diane and Ben-Hur. When pointed out to the director that there were thousands of years of difference between the different costumes and props, he replied, "Who knows?"
That's an epic response, if you ever hear one.
Basically just bugger off, I'm doing what I want. Following the preview of the film, a questionnaire was distributed asking viewers which scene they liked. One person answered, the scene where Robert Taylor saved Deborah Kerr from the fire. This was actually a stock footage scene taken from Quo Vadis.
Wow. Who would have thought that would ever happen?
And in Italy, Atlantis, Journey Beneath the Desert. No, sorry, just Journey Beneath the Desert was released. After a helicopter crash in the desert, the crew winds up in the underground city of Atlantis and gets mixed up in a slave revolt. Edgar G. Ulmer wrote to the producer that the making of this picture was a nightmare. Its first director quit the project after 2 days without shooting any relevant footage, unable to deal with the pressures of the production.
Why be a director in the first place when you can't even do that?
Well, Shirley Ulmer wrote, they didn't want to say anything to hurt the guy, but he sure didn't know what to do. Strange language and customs, perhaps. And that's how Edgar Ulmer replaced Borzage. But Ulmer also had to share a co-director credit with Giuseppe Massini, who is said never to have set foot on the film location to appease the Italian government, which had helped to subsidize the film. I see also Borzage, or Borzage maybe, had health issues, which contributed to him leaving.
Aww.
And that's all we have for today. Where can they find us, DJ?
They can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And they can also find us on thatsnotcanon.com, where we're an archive of our old episodes and new episodes, such as the new music podcast known as Music for the Mind. It is the synopsis of this is basically, welcome to the music of the mind. Combined forces, combined minds, and combined music passions for Jake, Serenity Imbued Brutality, Music, Metal Music Discovery Australia, and Shannon, the colorful writers, and Good Call Live. So here at Music for the Mind, we plan to discuss this in depth. For episode one, we have for your podcast host Jake and Shannon discussing the concept and interviewing each other. For all subsequent episodes, we will have various guests on the podcast to discuss various topics, all focused around music and mindfulness. Huh, interesting.
All right, well, look after yourself, stay hydrated, and we'll see you next time.
It's time for me to go and have fun with giant vampire ladies.
Bonk. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.